I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, so I've said this quite often about coming to AEW is I got a chance to meet and work with a lot of guys that I don't know a lot about. And Prince Nana is here, and I've heard your name for such a long time. And then, obviously, when Tony first got Ring of Honor, you started coming around, and I was like, who is this guy? And then seeing your work and kind of being around you a little bit more, it's very kind of a long history, very intriguing character here. So kind of tell us how we got lots to discuss, but how did you end up in AEW in the first place?
Chris, number one, thank you for having me on your podcast. This is what, the number one podcast on the podcast network?
We're going to say that, number one in the world.
But it's crazy because, AEW was a company that was kind of birthed, if you will, through ROH at that particular point in time. So that first all-in show, obviously I wasn't a part of that show, wanted to be a part of it, but history was made. The years went by, and I was beginning to kind of lose my luster because I had just, departed from Ring of Honor. They were still owned by Sinclair Broadcast Group. I had to make a decision whether I was going to continue trying to perform or if I was going to try and get a job somewhere else doing something else. Luckily, I touched base with a couple of good friends, Homicide, Carrie Silken, CD, and also Nick Buck. And these guys encouraged me. They were like, listen, there may not be an opportunity right now, but, keep doing your thing. Go out there. Try to get some, local bookings, some national bookings, and just get your embassy thing going again. And I took their advice. I did it. I did one dark match. It was like a tryout match in New York City with two, local guys. It went well. 6 months later, Chris, it's 6 months. I was like, I'm done. There's no going back to AEW. That was my little trinket. And then I'm in my basement. I'm there with one of my trusted advisors. And we're sipping on some tea, if you will, and just shooting the shit. And I just, out of the blue, get a text message. Hey, how soon can you make it out to Boston? I just jumped out of my seat. I was like, everyone in the business, they know that I don't drive. Oh, I can drive, but I usually, like to take, get driven or something of that nature. So I looked at the schedule. The schedule would have gotten me there at 8 p.m. So they're like, listen, we can't do that. We need to get you here immediately. I said, listen, I could jump in an Uber and I'll be there in the next 2 to 3 hours.
You're in New York City.
I'm in New York City in Brooklyn. Did the pricing for the Uber. It came out to $650. I was like, let's do it. But it doesn't end there, Chris. One Uber car came by. He saw where I was going. He said, sorry, I can't do it. The next one came, said, sorry, I can't do it. The third guy came. I begged him. I got on my knees for the first time in my life. Got down on my knees, and I begged the driver. I said, please, can you please take me to Boston? I'll do whatever you want, and I have a big tip for you. This is very, very important. He saw it in my eyes. He's like, get in the car. And that's when history was made. I ended up making it out there to Boston. I met Tony Khan. He hired me on the spot, and history was made.
So Tony obviously had seen your work from Ring of Honor, kind of knew what to expect,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I met Tony that first time that I came to AEW. I was walking through the hall with Homicide. And Tony, he usually busts out of his office to go to the Gorilla to, greet the fans. And he busted out his office and ran into me. And this is the first time I ever met him. And he actually was like, oh, my God, Prince Nana, what's up? And that was a great feeling to know that the owner of the next biggest company in the United States knew who I was. So that was a really good feeling.
And you had created kind of the embassy in Ring of Honor, and you've brought that here into AEW and kind of built it. So,
yes.
So have you always been a manager? Did you train to wrestle?
It's funny because I was actually a wrestler. I worked for ECWA for a very long time with Jim Kettner. I did some extra work during the Heat and the Metal era. And it's funny, I ran into you in the locker room when I was doing some extra work, and you knew me back then, just from like the Ring of Honor stuff. You're like, oh yeah, I know you, Prince Nana. But then, you know, a lot of years went by, and I kind of took a step back from being a pro wrestler and kind of, you know, capitalized on what I was really good at, which was being on the mic. And I became a manager in 2004. And then history was made there, too.
You know, it's interesting because it's not easy to get into pro wrestling as a wrestler, and probably even harder to get in as a manager because there's only a few spots available,
yes,
so to speak.
True.
So was it hard for you to kind of get – how did you kind of find your place in Ring of Honor to where you became a regular and part of the foundation there?
Well, you know, Ring of Honor, I was there from the very beginning. I was one of the first guys booked on the card. The way I got discovered with that company was through the booker at that time. He saw me at an independent event in New York City. He said he loved my work. He was a huge fan. And I was already like 4 or 5 years in the business because I started when I was 15 years old.
Wow.
I started when I was 15 with Johnny Rods. So he booked me on that inaugural show. I wrestled for the first 3 or 4 years. I was actually in the competition or the road to the championship match for the first championship belt, knocked out by the competitor Loki in that contest. And then, again, my strength was being on the mic and compelling the fans. And, you know, the booker at that time, Gabe, he took notice of that and pulled me to the side at a show and was like, hey, listen, I want you to start a faction. And I was delighted because in the back of my head, I kind of knew that that was the direction I eventually wanted to go. And he said, do you have a name for a faction that we can use right now? You guys are about to go out right now. And I was with Xavier, rest in peace. He was the second Ring of Honor world champion. I was like, the embassy. Mm-hmm. And he was like, that's perfect. And Bobby Cruz announced the embassy for the first time in 2004, and that's it. We've had almost a dozen performers, and a lot of them have gone on to do great things. One of them, Tommaso Ciampa, he was in the embassy. He got his start here in the embassy, so a lot of great history here.
So the embassy isn't so much just certain guys. It's kind of like the name of your family, so to speak.
Basically, yeah. At this point in time, it's our lineage. Mm-hmm. Just like in my Ghanaian culture, we have our different lineages and family trees. In wrestling, the embassy is probably one of the most royal groups and most sophisticated groups in professional wrestling, my friend.
And who's all in the embassy now in AEW right here?
Right now, it's the Mogul Embassy. We've extended and we've merged with Swerve Strickland, who's an awesome performer. I think he's going to be a champion one day.
Agreed.
We have the Gates of Agony, who are, you know, in product development currently, but they're also one half of the three-man world
trios
champions over at Ring of Honor. And we have Brian Cage, who's been, you know, kicking butt for the last, you know, maybe 10 years on the, you know, in the wrestling scene. And it's just an honor to be working with all of these guys.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So when you come in and Tony Khan kind of hires you, does he give you any direction on what he wants you to do? And is his idea to put you with these members of the embassy? Or do you have some input in that as well?
Well, it was, I don't know if you're aware, but everything happened so out of the blue. Tully Blanchard, who had his Tully Blanchard Enterprises going on, you know, something personally happened with him. So I guess he couldn't make that pay-per-view Death Before Dishonor. So when I did get into Tony Khan's office, which was a pretty intense meeting because there was just a lot of people there, a lot of the faces I knew. He was probably the only newer face. And he said, hey, Nana, I'm a huge fan. I want to bring back the embassy. Basically, what we're going to do is we're going to say that, you know, you purchased the embassy because you do have the purchasing power. and basically, we're going to move on from there. He basically just hired me on the spot. I worked per appearance for quite some time. And that was, you know, just because I wanted to kind of get my feet wet and really show people what I could do. And Tony seemed to have 110% faith in me from the day I started. So I thank him for that. I really do. He reminds me of Carrie Silkin. I hit it off with Carrie the moment I met him, when I found out he was going to be the owner of Ring of Honor. And the moment I, you know, started working with Tony, we hit it off too.
Were you working with Ring of Honor during the pandemic?
I wasn't working with Ring of Honor during the pandemic. I was working with Ring of Honor up until the Madison Square Garden show.
Gotcha.
And then I took my own hiatus just to get my life together. I had to figure things out. Ring of Honor was in a good place, but not in a good enough place for me personally. So I just had to, you know, make sure I got my head right, make sure I had things good at home. And I did that. And then when it was time to inch back into the business, you know, thank God for friends like Homicide and, again, Christopher Daniels and, you know, Nick Buck, Carrie Silkin, and a few other guys who got me off my butt. And I started doing, you know, getting on the road again, doing the indies and putting my name out there and started the group all over again.
What did you feel when Tony bought Ring of Honor? Were you excited about that?
Oh, that was a huge, forget it. Once he did that, I don't want to say that I jumped to conclusions, but when he did that, I was like, this is going to get interesting. And mainly for a lot of people who have been overlooked in pro wrestling, who may not, you know, have the opportunity to work in a company like AEW or one of the other bigger companies, Ring of Honor is definitely a great starting point for any new wrestler or any old wrestler who's really just trying to, you know, get their name out there again and try to, you know, work their way back up the ladder to go to a company like AEW.
You mentioned that you started at 15 years old. How did you get into the business?
Oh, so man, young? I cried to my mother. I cried to her, and she said no for a good maybe 3 or 4 months. Before that, I was a photographer, and I was a photographer for Johnny Rods, and I also was a photographer for a lot of the local magazines in New York City. Not in New York City, in the United States. So I would shoot at Madison Square Garden and submit my photographs. I started doing that for Johnny Rods also, so I shot all his guys, Big Vito, Devon Dudley, Spanish Angel, Taz, all of those guys I shot while they were wrestlers. When I was finally able to wrestle under Johnny, which was at about 16 years old, I had to get a waiver signed by my mom. And like I said, I had to cry and beg. And I told her, this is the only thing that I ever want to do in my life. This is exactly what I told her. This is the only thing I want to do in my life. Please just let me do it. She said, you can do it. She was, you know, reluctant at first. But she said, if you get a job and you save up your own money, and it wasn't a real job, just like a summer job, you can do whatever you want. And that's what I did. I saved up $2,000. I got it over to Johnny Rods. And I trained with some of the most toughest guys in the industry today.
It's funny, $2,000 is kind of the price for wrestling schools, whether it's 1990 or 2005 or whatever it may be. Yeah, that's exactly
the
choice.
It depends on what type of person you are. You either got the $2,000 price or you got the $3,000 price. It depends.
What was the summer job that you had to raise the money?
I actually worked at a summer camp, and I did that for many years. I became a director of one of the camps for many years, and we threw wrestling shows. I was the promoter. I would bring in guys. A lot of guys, you know, went on to do big things, like Jay Lethal. Forget it. I can go down the whole list. We had everyone come through to the camp and perform.
Tell us a little bit about Johnny Rods. I haven't really had a chance to talk about him. I think Tommy Dreamer trained with Johnny Rods.
Yeah, Tommy trained with him also.
So talk about him for...
Oh, man. He's... You know, Johnny Rods is one of the main reasons why I'm in the business. He gave me a shot, gave me an opportunity. He's a no-frills guy. He's going to tell you like it is. One of the toughest individuals, you know, whoever came to WWE and became, you know, a superstar and a Hall of Famer. One of the things that I learned from him in this business is that anybody can make it in this wrestling business. And, you know, you can never judge a book by its cover. And, you know, he was very big on the wheel. Okay, you know, if someone was helping me out in the ring, and once I accomplished that and I was able to, you know, master that, it was my turn to teach the next person. And he still goes by that mythology today, and it works at his school. You know, some of the, you know, some really good guys came out of that place, like Tommy Dreamer, Taz, Devon Dudley, you know, Big Vito, Spanish Angel, a whole host of guys, and all of them were great to me as a youngster coming up in the game, taught me a lot about the business, and I still stay in contact with a lot of them today. But Johnny Rods, forget it. He's a tough son of a gun. Sometimes, you know, he could be annoying, and sometimes he'll be like a father to you, and he'll talk you down, but at the end of the day, he's doing it for a reason. He's a great guy. I love him to death. Shout out Johnny Rods.
What was his training style? Kind of old school mentality?
Oh, yeah.
How did it work when you first started going to his school?
It was, a lot of it was, there was a lot of rolling. And we did so many rolls, and, you know, forget it, it was a roll after roll. If you didn't get the roll down packed, you weren't able to move to the next level, which was bumping. But, you know, basically his, you know, the way that he ran things over there was just like a well-oiled wheel. Everyone was there to help out. We got in there. We did our roles. We did the formats of the, you know, the chain wrestling. We had free stuff, you know, free for all wrestling in there where guys could get in there, you know, work out for about 10 minutes, tag out, get back in, tag out. So there was a lot of, you know, back and forth and just a lot of good times. A lot of my good friends are from Gleason's gym in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Brooklyn, right?
Yeah.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg. This is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
So let's talk about your lineage. You mentioned before, you know, you're Prince Nana from Ghana is kind of your background. But tell us your upbringing. Did you grow up in Ghana?
Well, actually, I was in Ghana for the first few years of my life. I'm born in the United States, but relocated to Ghana with the family. The royal lineage of my family starts on my father's side, but that doesn't exclude my mother's side of the family also. Once we did some DNA tracking as of late. But my connection to the royal family is through the seventh ruler of the Ashanti Kingdom, which his name is Nana Oseyao Okutu. And he's a direct relative of my paternal grandfather, which is from Kumowu, which is another town or another city in the Ashanti Kingdom. So when we're talking about lineage, we come from a maternal society where the queen mother, she would choose from, you know, a variety of different, you know, cousins and brothers within the family lineage, different last names, and choose the chief, which right now the chief of the Ashanti tribe is Osei Tutu II. All right. And, you know, when we go back to Ghana, that's who we show our respect to. But as far as, you know, everyone within the family, we have a part of that kinship within us. That's why we call ourselves princes and kings and queens and so on and so forth.
So you do have some actual royal blood in you.
Thank God we have some deep, 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 deep pockets, my friend. And my next trip to Ghana, God willing, will be in February. And in February, hopefully, I'll be able to meet personally my family member, Osei Tutu II, and also just, you know, tell him about all the great things that I've been doing as a part of the royal family.
So tell me what it's like in Ghana. When I'm thinking of you as part of the royal family, it's like, you know, coming to America, Prince Akeem type of a thing. What's it like?
It's something like that. You know, one thing about Ghanaians or Africans, but Ghanaians in general, is that we do everything overboard. All right, we like to do it, or we'd like to do it and do it well. So when you go to Ghana, just be ready to party. All right, even when we have funerals, it's a big party and a celebration. And when it comes to the tradition, you know, we make sure that we, you know, showcase it in a way that everyone can get involved. So when you see me with all of my jewels on and my robes and the different African, you know, clothing that I wear, it's more of a what is the word that I'm looking for? More of a celebration of our heritage and the royalty that we come from.
So is it kind of like a modern country? Is
Ghana is very modern in different places. Right now, the infrastructure over there is some of the top infrastructure that you can find throughout Africa. You know, there's a lot of trade that goes on with, you know, many different countries through Ghana, which include, you know, different minerals and different products that is produced and shipped throughout the world that comes from Ghana, which includes cocoa, which is chocolate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Ghana, you know, obviously the country can do better as far as an ecological or financial, you know, cooperation in this world. But we're definitely holding our own. The people are happy. We have an open invitation to all African Americans to come to Ghana without a visa to come and visit their homeland. You know, and we're probably the only country that does that in Africa.
Is there wrestling in Africa?
Oh, boy. Wrestling in Ghana is big. There's so many. I get so many emails weekly, Chris, from men and women who just want some advice from me on what they should do before they contact AEW or contact WWE. You know, it's a beautiful thing to go there. Or just to get videotapes and see, you know, them putting together shows and so on and so forth. There's shows in Ghana, there's shows in Nigeria, there's shows in South Africa, and hopefully one day AEW will be able to do a show on the continent itself.
Yeah, I've never been to Africa before.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You would have such a great time. The first two places you should go to is either Ghana or South Africa. You have a ball, my friend.
is it like you see, like, is there giraffes walking around and elephants?
No. If you go on the safari,
right,
yes.
Course,
if you go on the safari, yes. But, you know, it, beautiful scenery. The hotels are unbelievable. The beaches are great. You're going to have a great time. And the food, oh, my God. The fufu, you are going to love fufu.
What is fufu?
And peanut butter soup. It's yams. Basically, yams just crushed down together, all right? And it turns into a nice soft ball, and they put it into soup. And the soup that you would like it with is peanut butter soup with goat neck.
With turkey neck.
Delicious stuff.
Let's get back to wrestling. When you're talking about being a manager, who are some of your influences that you try and follow?
Oh, man. When you're talking about managerial greatness, you got to be talking about Bobby the Brain Heenan, who I got a chance to meet while I was a manager towards the end of his career. So it was good to meet him and talk to him and thank him for all that he's done. The Slick, Reverend Slick, was one of my favorites. You a jazz so bro. A jazz so bro. And I love that stuff so much. You have Brother Love. You have, you know, Paul Bearer. There's so many, you know, Paul Heyman. So many great names. I'm just trying to, you know, put my mark in the business, all right? Make champions, make great moments, and inspire people to do what it is that they want to do in life.
So what did Bobby give you any advice, or what did Bobby say?
Well, you know, at that time, Bobby was going through his you know, situation. So it was more of a handshake and an eye wink, and right. That was that good was enough
yeah,
for
yeah,
me.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And that said enough for me, because, you know, he actually came to Ring of Honor before he got sick. So he knows about the product. He met a lot of us beforehand. My first meeting with him, I didn't really get to speak to him because, you know, it's like, this is Bobby the Brain Heenan. Let me leave him alone. But, you know, that second time around when I got to meet him, it was really good to get that eye wink from him.
Let's talk about, you said you're at Ring of Honor from the very start.
Yes.
So how did Ring of Honor actually start? Because it became quite a big company, and it is now again. But tell us about the
beginning. Absolutely.
You
know, it's interesting because there's so many varieties to the story. So many different varieties to the story. But my outtake of the story is it started in New York City. Okay, it started in New York City in the Elks Lodge. Okay, and at that time, you know, it was just a regular independent company there. They called it something else. It wasn't connected to Ring of Honor or anything like that. But a lot of the owners of Ring of Honor used to travel with those independent shows to sell their merchandise and so on and so forth. So after they saw, like, you know, all of these young guys from New York, and we're talking about me, we're talking about Loki, we're talking about Homicide, we're talking about Xavier, we're talking about the SATs, we're talking about, you know, those guys that at that time were undeniable in the wrestling business as far as on an independent level, with the next step being, you know, the big time. These guys right here were unstoppable. You know, and with those guys and then the mix of the Samoa Joes, you know, and the Christopher Daniels and the Scoot Andrews that came from the West Coast and so on and so forth, Ring of Honor was born. And you know, it really started with, you know, a bunch of New York wrestlers kind of just joking around and saying that, you know, we needed something, you know, to fill the void of ECW, which, you know, just went out of business, you know, and we kind of just needed something in New York to fill that void, or in the hardcore lane to fill that void. And Ring of Honor did that. That first show was a very special show. And I don't know what exactly it was that made the show special. Mm-hmm. But after it, we all knew that we had something and that we were on to something and that we all needed to bust our butt in order to maintain it and to call it our own.
So what was kind of the first wave of seeing the popularity of Ring of Honor start? Because mostly you mentioned was a New York-based company. When right. did you start branching out, and when did it start to grow?
Well, it was a Philadelphia-based company, but you know, the company that it kind of like piggybacked off of kind of died out. Ring of Honor became its thing, its own thing. And I think right around the time when we started doing the embassy stuff in 2004, is when it really started to get over a hump. And that hump, it wasn't easy. You know, I was a part of not only the talent, but I was also working with Carrie Silkin in the office, you know, booking venues and so on and so forth. But we really got our first big, big break venue-wise when we went to the New Yorker Hotel, which is right next door to the Hammerstein Ballroom. And I was instrumental in getting that building booked for Ring of Honor after another building that we booked canceled on us the night before the show, or two nights before the show. So, you know, thank God I came to the rescue, and we had one of our greatest shows ever at that event, and it was Joe versus Kenta Kobashi.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was one of ROH's, at that time, most sold DVD, one of the biggest events that we had, most watched events, and I'm proud to have been a part of that.
So what are some of the highlights for you around that time frame, some of the things that you were involved in?
Oh, forget it. Jimmy Rave, rest in peace.
Jimmy Rave
was, forget it, he was the golden child of the embassy and of Ring of Honor. He's truly missed today. He's one of my best and most fondest memories of, you know, building the embassy. He was the crown jewel, you know, the whole moniker crown jewel. I think we, you know, the embassy was the first ones to use that in the wrestling business. And we used it for Jimmy Rave. We also had Bison Smith, rest in peace to him, who was, you know, a huge part of like the building of the embassy. And we just, you know, went through a lot of guys as far as competition. We're talking about CM Punk, you know, we're talking about, you know, Colt Cabana, you know, a whole bunch of guys that we just kind of went through as far as, you know, our rivals. And a lot of them went on to do big and bad things. And I'm proud of them for doing what they're doing. You know, it's a great thing, my friend. But, you know, my whole experience in Ring of Honor was, it was great. I can't, you know, there's bumps in the road and there's a lot of, you know, different, you know, things that may have happened that may seem negative, but I wouldn't change it for a thing. I wouldn't change one piece of that for a thing.
How about from a physical standpoint? Obviously, as a manager and you're a wrestler, so you know how to take bumps. Have you taken some big bumps in Ring of Honor and some stories that you have, injuries or something?
Red Dragon. They brought me out and they put me in one of their moves, and forget it. That was it. And I've been taking bumps all of my life, but as soon as they put me into their move, that was it.
Bobby Fish, Kyle O'Reilly.
Yeah, Kyle O'Reilly.
Yeah,
those guys are some tough son of a guns, man. Yeah. And I've been taking bumps from everyone, from the Midnight Express all the way up till, you know, God knows who. But Red Dragon, definitely one tough. They didn't, you know, hurt me or anything like that, but their move.
Just feeling it, yeah.
Exactly. I definitely felt it.
Well, you mentioned the Midnight Express. How did you take a bump from them?
Oh, my God. They hit me in the nuts with Jim Cornette's, what you call it, racket. I still have to give someone a receipt for that. But those guys are great, man. They're great. They're great.
And why were you working with the Midnight Express? Is that, well, is that Bobby Eaton and
that was Bobby Eaton
and Stan Lane?
Exactly. At that time, the embassy was beefing with them.
Oh, like, gotcha.
Hey, listen, anyone who came in there, they wanted a piece of the action. We took all comers, my friend, all comers, and that included the Midnight Express.
So let's talk more about your time here in AEW and some of the highlights for you since you started here. Obviously, you mentioned the members of the embassy. Yes. Talk about some of the moments that you've had. I mean, and one of the big moments that I really enjoy is your dance down to the ring.
Oh, my God, don't stop.
That's the one that everyone talks about.
Don't stop. Well, you know, it's crazy because the first day that I met the trio of Brian Cage, Toa, and Khan, I didn't know who I was going to be working with that day. So I'm walking in the back looking like a maniac. And I just see these three guys in the corner, and they're huddled. And I see one big Samoan guy, and he's like giving me this smile, like this evil smile. And come to find out, they were the guys that I was acquiring from Tully Blanchard. And boy, has it been a great, great, great ride. Since then, I've worked with Brian and the Gates of Agony, and we've catapulted each and every one of us in the group. You know, we've catapulted ourselves to a level where we're undeniable, where, the people who put the matches together decide to put us in the matches because they know that they're going to get a hard-hitting, exciting presentation. And, you know, working with Swerve has been, you know, probably one of the smartest things that has ever happened as far as my character is concerned. And I asked Swerve this the other day. I was having a conversation with him. I said, you know, who came up with this idea to put us together, you know? And he was like, it's 100% Tony. And for Tony to be the one to put us together and for this magic to happen, it's unbelievable because I feel like I'm where I need to be. I feel like I'm where I need to be. I could showcase all sides of Prince Nana, from the sophisticated to the urban to the funny to the quiet. Everything could be showcased through Swerve and the embassy. So that's really exciting.
It's amazing too because you're on Ring of Honor, but now you're on AEW Dynamite quite often. Yeah. Collision, whatever it may be. So you're basically all over the shows now,
all over the place, and I'm dancing. All right, and let me tell you, the dance, how that came about was I got some good information from the AEW office. I believe it was during the Canada trip or maybe a little after that because Canada took a lot out of everybody. Mm-hmm. I love Canada.
Long trips to get
exactly.
In and out. Not a lot of directs to Regina.
Yeah, to Regina. I love that place.
Yeah.
But I was in my room, got some good news, and next thing you know, I put on Instagram. I put on the Swerve song, and I was like, I'm going to just dance to this. And I just started dancing that same dance. I did that same dance. I taped it. We went maybe about 2 weeks. And you know, when I was initially walking him to the ring, I had a little motion in my step, a little pep in my step. But I said to myself, maybe 2 weeks into that, I looked at that video again and said, you know what, I'm going to do this dance. And I did it one night, and boom, history again was made. And just since then, every week people are requesting me to do it. I did it in London in front of 80,000 people. We're getting memes. We're getting people, you know, doing the challenge. So it's definitely a great thing.
Did you ever have any interactions with WWE? Any tryouts there at all?
Oh, like too many. Yeah. Too many. Way, a lot of interactions. I wrestled Crash Holly at Madison Square Garden. Rest in peace to him.
For what? A TV taping
or something? It was for a TV taping.
Oh, that's
metal.
Cool.
So I put him, you know, I was working him. I also worked Steve Blackman at Nassau Coliseum.
Oh, that goes back a long way.
That goes a long way. So I was actually there during the WWF era, right, before it became WWE. And then in between that, I also had different tryouts with the company where they brought me in, you know, to try out as a manager, and they know me pretty well. I don't know exactly why, you know, I never ended up getting a job there particularly, but, you know, I'm a believer in everything happens for a reason. Mm-hmm. You know, everything happens for a reason. I didn't think that I wouldn't make it in the pro wrestling business. But thank God everything fell into the place that it fell into, because I wouldn't want to be anywhere else other than AEW.
So you never had one of the official tryouts where you got to go to the performance?
Oh, no, I never went down there. Yeah. I think the biggest thing, they know that, you know, my pockets are deep and that I may not want to relocate all the way to Florida for the rest of my life. I love living in New York City. New York City is my second home outside of Ghana. It's going to be very hard to get me.
Florida's 3 hours further away from Ghana, too.
Hey, so, you know what? It is, but there's too many lizards running around Florida for me, my friend.
Were you a wrestling fan as a kid? Did you have experiences of trying to meet the guys and going to the shows?
Well, you know what? I didn't get too crazy with the meeting part, because my mom, again, she was a very strict Ghanaian woman. Very strict with, you know, education, and I have five brothers and sisters.
Oh, wow.
Right, and I'm the last born, so I'm the black sheep doing the wrestling business, so you can imagine. We have doctors, lawyers, we have physicians that are my brothers and sisters, and my nephew is actually a doctor right now also. But growing up as a kid, pro wrestling was everything once I watched WrestleMania 8. I saw wrestling before that, and it was interesting to me. But, you know, after getting to borrow the WrestleMania tape from one of my neighbors, his name is TJ, I still tell him about it till today, I watched Ric Flair versus Macho Man Randy Savage. And not only was that match really good and was great, an historic match, but the storyline leading into it with the whole thing with Elizabeth, you know, cheating on Macho Man Randy Savage, it just totally had me compelled and involved. And after that match, I knew I wanted to be in the wrestling business.
Did you go to the shows back in those days?
Oh, yeah. I used to go to Madison Square Garden. I was a part of the WWF fan club. So, you know, whenever they sent out the package, they would send you a free ticket. So I got a free ticket to a show like every time they came to New York. And then when I got really smart, which was in high school, where I was a big deal in high school, I was the editor of the yearbook at the high school. I was the senior speaker at my high school, which is John Dewey High School in Brooklyn, New York. You know, it was just, where were we at that point?
We're just talking about you going to the shows and then
seeing. Yeah, so basically, you know, from being in Dewey and becoming a photographer in high school, I was able to start going to the shows like Madison Square Garden, Nassau Coliseum, and I started to photograph. And I photographed some of the greats, which includes Billy Gunn. Billy Gunn, who I see in the back here, I photographed him when I was 13 years old as the smoking guns in Madison Square Garden, Shawn Michaels, all the greats. And I photographed for a very long time for Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazine.
Oh, wow.
And I started there as a child working as a photographer, which is just crazy to me when I think back at how crazy I was as an individual.
What's the secret to being a good pro wrestling ringside photographer?
Stay out of the way. Stay out of the way and make sure the guys get their pictures ASAP. Okay? As long as you make sure the guys get their pictures, maybe a day after you take the pictures, they're going to be your friend and they're going to help you out in life.
Did you ever have anybody give any trouble when you were
a photographer?
Yeah.
Oh, no, not at all. You see, when I was a photographer, I wasn't allowed to be at ringside. So when I did shoot for WWE in Madison Square Garden, I shot from the seats. But, you know, again, I was saving up and working like a maniac trying to be. And I bought a large focus lens and I was able to shoot from my seat at that time. But no one ever really gave me problems on the independent shows or at Johnny Rod's when I was shooting.
As we start to wind down, kind of tell us what it was like to work in Madison Square Garden. You mentioned actually wrestle there after being there as a fan and seeing it all. And
you know, it was crazy because looking back, and I look back at that video all the time. I think I was like 21 or maybe 20 or something like that. And it was surreal at that time. It was huge, and it was an unbelievable opportunity. At that point, I was in the wrestling business for like 5 years. Not the wrestling business, but I've been training and doing independent shows for maybe 5 years, so a couple of years or something like that. So it was an unbelievable experience that I thought to myself, maybe this will be the last time that I do something this big. But then Ring of Honor ended up coming to Madison Square Garden. I wasn't on that show, but I feel like I had a lot to do with Ring of Honor getting to that show. And again, it's just a blessing to have done Wembley, which overshadowed my Madison Square Garden debut. But again, it's truly a blessing to have even been able to step into a ring at Madison Square Garden to do this, let alone Wembley.
How was your Wembley experience?
Oh, man.
Tell us what you thought about that.
The fact that you were there was unbelievable. Your performance was great. Sting, that guy is unbelievable. Yeah. I'm still afraid of him. He kidnapped me a couple of weeks ago. We had an unbelievable match with Swerve at All In. And man, I'm still taking it in. I still catch shivers till today thinking about 80,000 people just watching us do our thing on the grandest stage of them all in AEW. And, you know, we were the first company to really do it at that grand of a level. So it was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Last things, tell us a little bit about Xavier. You mentioned that he's not with us anymore. Don't really know a lot about him, and I've never discussed him on Talk Is Jericho, so kind of give him a little bit of props from his props.
Xavier was a sweetheart.
Yeah.
What a great guy he was. He was, actually, this is a true story, the first like friend I met in the wrestling business. The first day I went to get my license in New York State, for the New York State, you know, pro wrestling license. He was in the office, and we started talking, and we hit it off. He was telling me where he trained. I told him where I trained. And then we lost contact for maybe 2 years, and then we ended up popping up at an indie together. And since then, we were friends, for like friends till the end, all the way until he passed away. I think I spoke to him maybe a week before he passed away, and I still think about him every day today. He's a great guy, great individual. His son is big now. He was very much into his family. He loved the pro wrestling business, helping people out. And he was one of the true champions of Ring of Honor. And you know, I'm glad that you brought him up. Him and Jay are always going to be on my mind. You know, Jay Briscoe, Xavier, you know, and there's a few other guys.
Jimmy Rave.
Of course, and it's crazy that a lot of these guys came from the embassy, but it just, you know, goes to show you how serious I am about leaving a mark in this industry. I love it so much. This is all I've got, and you know, I'm just blessed. I'm blessed to be sitting here talking to you, and just blessed to continue performing for the fans at this level as Prince Nana.
Last question for you. What's your favorite match you've ever been involved with as a manager?
I was on pay-per-view. Actually, it was on pay-per-view, and I got coerced into wrestling again back in 2012 for Ring of Honor. And I did a match versus, you know, he was a part of the embassy at that time, R.D. Evans. And then he became my arch nemesis because he was trying to break up the embassy. So we ended up going through a whole feud that lasted a couple of months, and the culmination was at the Hammerstein Ballroom, one-on-one, and the fans ate it up. And that was probably, you know, I did all the things that I thought I would never do as a wrestler. I was doing superplexes from the top rope. I was diving out the ring. I did everything that people thought I couldn't do. And at the end of that, a lot of the guys came up to me and said, "Nana, you proved why you belong in this business." And all I could do is just cry and say thank you.
Well, dude, it's a great story. I know your pockets are deep. I saw you tip me a little bit here to have you on the show, which is great, man. I appreciate that. So big show tonight for the embassy and for AEW, and it's good to talk to you and have you here, man.
Thank you so much, Chris. What a blessing. The embassy forever.
Can you speak Ghana?
Yeah, of course.
Give us a message in Ghana.
Bientôt, ni nanose yao. mba ke bonoko ya ogbe ya no ba o fine.
He said it first, baby.